You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. How is the brain wired? How do our billions of nerve cells communicate with each other? And when we learn something or remember something, how do those cells and that wiring change and interact so that we remember and we learn what we're trying to learn? My next guest, Eric Kandel, has spent much of his career trying to answer those questions and realizing that the complexities of the human brain might make it a bit difficult to research the subject. He has instead chosen a much simpler organism, the sea slug. A sea slug has only about 20,000 nerve cells in all, so compared to the billions and billions in the human brain, it's a much more manageable system. And his studies of learning and memory in the sea slug and in the lab, that mainstay of the lab, the mouse, have established the molecular basis of memory and earned him the 2000 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. So we're going to talk with Dr. Eric Kandel. Give us a call if you'd like to talk with him. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. The formally introduced Dr. Kandel, as I say, he is the 2000 Nobel Laureate in Physiology or Medicine, a senior investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute and university professor in the Center for Neurobiology and Behavior at Columbia University School of Physicians and Surgeons. He joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you, Ira. I'm delighted to be here.
Let's talk about how you got started in your career. Did you always know you wanted to work on sea slugs?
No, I didn't have the foggiest notion when I started. I would become interested in snails. I went to medical school to become a psychoanalyst because I was interested in how the human mind works. And only in medical school did I think that knowing something about the brain would be useful. Mm-hmm. And so I learned some brain biology, and based upon that, I was eligible to go as a postdoctoral fellow to the NIH. And at the NIH, I began to focus in on memory, but initially, I focused in on the mammalian brain, the homologue of your brain and mine, and studied the properties of the hippocampus, that part of the brain that is known to be involved in people in memory storage. Mm-hmm. I did this in 1957-58, and I was able to make some nice beginnings in the hippocampus, but I thought it was just too complicated to study at that point, and I looked for a simpler experimental system. It is one of the cornerstones of biological thought that for every problem, there is a good experimental system that is particularly advantageous. And so I began to look around for a nervous system that had few nerve cells capable of participating in complex behavior, interesting behavior that could be modified by learning. And the snail met many of these criteria. In addition, sea snails, and I work on a particular sea snail called Aplysia, have not only few cells, but they have the largest nerve cells in the animal kingdom. So the cells are gigantic. You can see them with your naked eye.
You can actually see them. You can stick a probe in them and
see
them.
That's right. That's right. And so in these snails, I was able to work out a very simple behavior that could be modified by learning, undergo both short-term and long-term memory, work out the neural circuitry that controls that behavior, and address a number of interesting questions. For example, we found that the basic neural circuitry that controls the behavior is put together by genetic and developmental processes and is amazingly precise. Given sensory neurons always connect to the same interneurons and motor neurons in every single animal of the species. Hmm. And that, of course, raised the question, how do you reconcile this invariance with the ability of the behavior to be modified by learning? And so we looked at this neural circuit, this neural architecture of behavior during the learning process, and we found that even though the connections between nerve cells were specified, their exact strength was not. And what learning and memory does in these experimental animals, as it does in your brain and mine, is to alter the strength of pre-existing connections.
And how does it do that?
It activates molecular processes in the cell. In Aplysia, it activates a system called the cyclic AMP signaling system, and this gives rise to transient alterations in synaptic strength by activating a signaling molecule called a kinase. If you stimulate repeatedly, practice makes perfect, to produce long-term memory, That same set of signaling molecules goes to the nucleus of the cell, turns on genes, and those genes give rise to the growth of new synaptic connections. So insofar, Ira, you remember anything about our conversation, it is because your brain will be different as a result of this conversation than it was beforehand.
So you found the mechanisms that make the difference between short-term and long-term memory.
That's right. That's right. It involves alterations in gene expression and the growth of new synaptic connections.
And forgetting? Did you find out how you forget something? Does that have a reverse process?
It has a reverse process. You retract and lose those same synaptic connections.
And does the genetic part change also?
Yes, the genes turn off.
Wow.
But it's really interesting from several points of view,
yeah,
because we tend to think of genes as being the controllers of behavior. We see that mutations in genes give rise to Lou Gehrig's disease, to schizophrenia, to depression. But we don't realize or we don't think about the fact that genes also are controlled by environmental influences. Genes can be switched on and off, and learning experiences and emotional experiences are very important in accomplishing that, switching genes on and off.
That really is something. That is something. You have to think about that.
It's very, very interesting. Moreover, the ability to switch those genes on and off and the ability to grow new synaptic connections varies as a function of age.
Hmm.
So it's very difficult for guys like you and me at this particular point in our life to learn Indic philology or to learn Greek. But it would have been extremely easy for us to do this when we were 7 years old, 8 years old, up to puberty. Extremely easy to learn new languages. And if we look in the brain, we see that the ability to change connections is much, much greater early in life than it is later.
Now, we have a scientist we've been following over the years. You probably know him, Robert Stickgold, I think, at Harvard, who does experiments with memory in his students.
Mm-hmm.
And he found that, he found some interesting, he found, first of all, that his students, if they don't get enough sleep at night, will forget what he's taught them.
Right.
And I said, that rules me out because I'm so old, I don't get more than 5-6 hours of sleep. He says, you're right, you're never going to learn this stuff. It was not very encouraging. I hear you saying the same thing now.
No, you're doing fine.
It's very funny. You have at the Nobel Prize Award ceremony, you said that if the 20th century was defined by the biology of the gene, then this century will be defined as the biology of the mind. Is that what you meant by connecting the genes and the mind together?
Yes, but I would go even beyond that. I would say that if you look at all of science, there are two fundamental questions that really intrigue the scientific community and, I would say, the public at large. One is the nature of the universe, astrophysics, and the other is the nature of the human mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in terms of biology, the human mind poses the greatest challenge in confronting us, not only in terms of our wanting to understand how we function, how we tick, what makes us what we are, but also to help us overcome the devastating illnesses that affect the human mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that there is going to be an increasing interest among young people, the driving force of the scientific community, in problems of brain functioning, mental disorders.
Do you think we are able to study and understand consciousness too?
That is the ultimate of the ultimate. It's the most difficult problem confronting the biology of the brain and probably confronting all aspects of science. But, I'm a delusional optimist, and unless I'm absolutely convinced that we can't do it, I really don't worry about it at this point. I think problems of consciousness are not for the 21st century. They're probably for the 22nd century. And I think maybe the next program we worry about that, Ira, and this program, it's premature to worry about whether we can do it.
All right.
I think what is interesting is that a number of very gifted people like Francis Crick, Christoph Koch, Gerald Edelman, Tony DiMasio are beginning to think of how to approach these problems experimentally.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still a little bit vague, but I think they're beginning to define certain subsystems. For example, Francis Crick thinks the study of attention might be the royal road to consciousness. Well, attention, Ira, you and I can tackle.
Okay.
I think that's something we can do.
Okay, I'll pay attention.
Good. you don't have to do it after this call is over, but for this call, I want you to pay attention.
I'll give it my best. You don't know how hard that is. Let me ask you this question. We talk a lot about stem cell research, and you know, it's been in the news lately, and especially when we talked about Alzheimer's disease and Mrs. Reagan trying to bring attention to using stem cells in the brain. Is there any role for stem cells in learning and memory or possibly repairing memories?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that you say that. In the last few years, that possibility has emerged in full dress. There is a small cluster of cells in the hippocampus, in the dentate gyrus of the hippocampus, that has stem cell capabilities. And it turns out that people who are, well, let me step back a second. Mm-hmm. What its actual function in learning and memory is not yet known, although there is indirect evidence that it may have a role. And the evidence comes from two sources. One particularly impressive is that when people become depressed, chronically depressed, they tend to show a cognitive deficit, which is manifest with a weakening of memory. And if you look at the hippocampus of people who are chronically depressed, the hippocampus, which is the structure important for memory storage in people, is a little bit shrunken. You can produce animal models of depression. They're not perfect, but they respond two drugs that are effective in human depression. Mm-hmm. Antidepressant medication like selective serotonin uptake inhibitors, drugs like Prozac. And when you see these animals respond to the animal model of depression with these drugs, they also show an interesting behavior of their stem cells. In response to depression, there's a decrease of new stem cells being produced and introduced into the hippocampus. And with treatment, that capability returns.
Hmm. Very interesting.
So that has made one think that maybe this has an important contribution. Now, it takes about 10 days to 2 weeks for new cells to form and to be incorporated. So it's not going to be important for your remembering what you and I are talking about. But maybe when you and I finish talking, if you and I remember what we're talking about, it's going to occupy a certain amount of the computational space of the hippocampus. So in order to make room for further remembrance in the future, so this is sort of a forward-looking program.
Right.
It prepares the hippocampus for future capabilities. And that's how people are thinking about it now.
Interesting. Very interesting.
And I should tell you that there are various peoples of thinking who are thinking that maybe they would develop drugs that are useful as antidepressants that work by stimulating these stem cells. Now, that could be pretty nifty.
Wow. Talking with Eric Kandel on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. Dr. Kandel, we'll put aside consciousness for a while because we know that's a little too big to bite off. But where do you see the cutting edge in brain research and memory research going now?
I think the cutting edge is to try to do in the mammalian brain, particularly in the primate and the human brain, what is now routine in aplysia and in simple systems like the fly and the worm, to work out complex neural circuitry that underlies action, perception, thought. When I lift up a glass of water and bring it to my mouth to drink it, I undergo a skilled movement that is extremely difficult for a robot to do. It's a very complex engineering program, and exactly how that is done is a challenge that neurobiology is not capable of tackling. When you and I talk, it's amazing how complex the computation goes on. I mean, we speak our sentences automatically. I don't even know where the verb and the noun is in the sentence. I don't even know whether there is a noun and a verb in the sentence. But you and I understand each other perfectly well. So there's amazing capability of you to fill out ambiguities in my sentence structure. And for me to understand what you're saying, these are wonderful computational tasks that the brain accomplishes, and we don't understand how that comes about. And to do that is a major, major advance. Moreover, in the last 15 years, there's been enormous benefit to medicine because of what molecular biology has contributed to neurological illnesses, understanding of multiple sclerosis, of epilepsy, of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. That has all advanced dramatically. Neurology has been revolutionized by molecular biology. But if you look at psychiatry, the progress has been much more subtle. Now, why has this been so? One of the reasons is that many psychiatric illnesses are also in part genetically determined. But unlike neurological illnesses, Huntington's disease, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, diseases like that, in which they're often individual, single genes that do the bad deed, almost all psychiatric disorders are what are called polygenic, multigenic. There are lots of little genes that have to combine in a certain way in order to distort the functioning of mental processes. To find lots of little genes acting together is much more difficult than to identify the single bad character in the lot. So the genetic task in psychiatry has been much, much more difficult. But we're beginning to make a little progress there, and I think in the next 10 years, it's going to be the decade of mental health, mental illness. I think we're going to make fantastic progress.
It almost seems like psychiatry has turned into chemistry now.
You're right. This is not to say that talking therapy isn't important, but I've argued for a long time, as I've tried to indicate in our conversation here, that when you and I talk, chemicals in our brain are altering. So we're really influencing each other not only on a psychological level, but also on a biological level, because every mental process has an underlying biological process. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that insofar as psychotherapy works, insofar as I feel better as a result of this interview than I did before this interview, it is because anatomical changes occur in my brain. And if that's so, sooner or later we should be able to detect this with imaging methodology. So you should be able to image me before I undergo psychotherapy, see what's wrong with my brain and how that relates to the complaints that I have, and then evaluate me after psychotherapy to see whether my improvement correlates with any anatomical change that has occurred in the brain. If we can do that, we would revolutionize psychotherapy. We'd take it out of this borderline questionable area of medical therapies and put it on the solid biological basis.
Wow, that's a lot to
think. That's a lot of things to hope for.
It is. And we're going to take a short break while we sit here and think about that and come back and talk with more with Dr. Eric Kandel, talk about what else he's hoping for, and take your questions. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Don't go away. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour with Dr. Eric Kandel. He's the 2000 Nobel Laureate in Physiology or Medicine, a senior investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, university professor in the Center for Neurobiology and Behavior at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons in New York. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's see who else wants to pick Dr. Kandel's brain on the phone today. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Carl on the cell phone in Peoria. Hi, Carl.
Hi.
You still in Peoria?
I am. I am indeed. I had a question for Dr. Kandel, and that had to do with the concept of plasticity in learning. What role does plasticity have in learning? I attended a lecture a while back concerning memory and the brain, and the lecturer mentioned this concept, and I thought our listeners might be interested in learning about it.
All right, thanks.
Plasticity refers to the ability to modify behavior, and it's used in two ways. One is used as a synonym for learning. So your behavior is plastic. You can modify it in various ways by different forms of learning. But it is also used, and more commonly used, to refer to the changes that occur in the nervous system when learning occurs. Those are called plastic changes. The ability to change the strength of a synaptic connection is called plasticity.
Mm-hmm.
So the most common use of it is as a way of designating the kinds of changes that occur in the brain as a result of a learning experience.
1-800-989-8255. Back to the phones. Sean in St. Louis. Hi, Sean.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to, a moment ago, the doctor mentioned psychotherapy as sort of a borderline scientific way of dealing with certain types of disorders. And I just wanted to point out that that's actually not true. In many cases, psychotherapy has been found to be much more effective than drugs, for instance, in depression, anxiety, over the long term. It seems to me that what the doctor is doing is using a sort of reductionist fallacy, and that is to say, if we can learn more and more and more about the neurons, that that'll tell us about consciousness eventually, and that that will explain, like, for instance, the phenomenology of another human being. And it seems to me that that has been something that's been eschewed by the scientific community, or large portions of the scientific community, people like Karl Popper, for quite some time, as sort of a positivist throwback that has not been particularly helpful in advancing science. And so I wanted to know what the doctor thought about that.
Dr. Kandel?
You make two points. One is, you're absolutely right when you say that psychotherapy is not simply a marginal therapeutic effort. I said that and I misspoke. What I meant was that there are good reasons to believe that in conjunction with drug therapy, psychotherapy is often extremely helpful. Moreover, there are certain indications for psychotherapy as a treatment by itself. The problem with it and why it has fallen out of favor with the medical community is that there are not objective ways of showing whether it works, and whom it works for, and what combination of therapist and patient is optimal for particular kinds of therapeutic experience. And I think if one can get an independent measure of therapeutic outcome, and even sort of diagnosis of run-of-the-mill neurotic disorders, I think one would put the ability to evaluate the outcome of psychotherapy and to study it on a completely different basis.
Well, I think that you're making a mistake there, though, because I suppose what you would consider to be an objective measurement of that would be some sort of something that you would look at under a microscope, for instance. But in that regard, you're assuming that these disorders exist without being able to determine that. For instance, there's no laboratory test for schizophrenia or depression or anxiety. Yet we can. You're very comfortable with saying that drugs can be helpful for these disorders. At the same time, you're not comfortable with saying that therapy is useful because you ask the people or members of their family or their employers, and they find oftentimes marked improvements on the basis of therapy. And so that seems to me that you're...
All right, why don't we slow down, because you're covering a lot of ground. One is, I want to make absolutely clear that you understand what I'm saying. Every single psychological problem has a biological cause. This is not a philosophical position. This is a fact. Every mental event comes from the brain, number one. Two, insofar as there is a disorder of mental processes, it must reflect a disorder of the brain. We may not be able to detect it with the methodology now available, but there's no question about it. For example, schizophrenia, which I can tell you from personal experience, I'm a trained psychiatrist, does not respond to psychotherapy, has anatomical changes associated with the brain.
Actually, it has true. That's not true. There are many studies that have gone on in the UK that have...
I have participated in studies in the Mass Mental Health Center at Harvard which showed that psychotherapy by itself does nothing for schizophrenia.
Not okay? By itself, but it certainly does improve it.
There is no question that in conjunction, with antipsychotic medication, it helps people organize their lives. I'm a strong believer, as an adjunct to other therapeutic approaches, psychotherapy can be useful. In schizophrenia, you're picking a bad example, because without drugs, we were nowhere.
But that's not the case for depression and anxiety. Oftentimes, they...
Depression and anxiety, depending upon the severity of it. If you were close to suicide, I would make absolutely sure that, number one, you're hospitalized, and number two, you're on antidepressant medication, or that you're eligible for electroconvulsive therapy. There's also no question that psychotherapy is likely to help you, but I'd make absolutely sure that you have stable psychopharmacological intervention. So we're not disagreeing about the fact that psychotherapy can be helpful. What got psychotherapy into difficulty were two things. One is, people claimed that it could treat everything, and we now know it has a very selective, important but very selective utility, number one. And number two, the outcome of psychotherapy is dependent not only on the nature of the illness, but on the nature of the therapist. That's a very tricky dimension. And I would argue that the only way we're going to get around that is to get independent ways of evaluating it.
Thanks for calling, Sean. Dr. Kandel, you seem like you're very passionate about this subject.
I'm very much interested in this area, yes.
Yeah. And it sounds like you have thought about it.
I have indeed.
1-800-989-8255. And I know from your history that at one time you thought about being a psychiatrist.
That's right. I am a psychiatrist.
Well, but
I'm incompetent, but I am a psychiatrist.
And you're from Vienna, too,
that's
right?
That's right. That explains everything.
And so why didn't you continue along the classic psychiatric route about being a psychiatrist?
Life is a crapshoot in a way. I found that I liked research so much, I didn't plan. It was an accidental happening, and I liked it so much, and I thought in the long run I would make a more useful contribution to psychiatry by doing basic science than by doing psychotherapy.
Interesting.
And I must tell you, if you just sort of evaluate my generation of psychiatrists who did primarily psychotherapy and my generation of biologists who did primarily biology, we are a happier lot, I think. At least in terms of our career, biology has blossomed fantastically during the 50 years I've been doing science. While psychoanalysis, which was really the queen of the therapeutic sciences in psychiatry when I was a house officer in 1960, is now in decline.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was a time when, you know, you couldn't walk the streets of New York without bumping into four or five people who are in analysis. It's very difficult now, even for the most gifted analysts, to fill up their practice.
Even for Woody Allen, huh?
No, if he were a therapist, he would probably fill up the... He probably has enough problems for several analysts, you mean.
Well, he made a career out of talking about therapy in his movies, or right at that period that you're talking about in the 70s when everybody was talking about analysis. And then at that time, did people believe that studying the biology of the brain could inform the practice of psychiatry? They had no interest in that.
Obviously, there were some. I mean, yeah. I did, and I was not unique. But it's a shift in public opinion. You see, at that point, very, very few psychiatrists thought actively about this. They thought, very much like Sean did, that maybe mental processes are way out there in the ether someplace. They didn't acknowledge that every mental process must have an underlying biological process. I think now there's a much stronger consensus on that point.
We're talking with Eric Kandel this hour in Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let's go to the phones. Lots of people want to talk. Tom in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hi, Tom.
Hello. This is certainly a rewarding and fascinating conversation that you're having on the air this afternoon. I'm calling in to put my 10 cents worth in. I'm a professional writer, a progressive democratic advocate, and a student of political and social science. And I'm calling to ask, first of all, physiologically, why a person's brain can't be stimulated intellectually so as throughout their lifetime to create new brain cells and new nerve pathways and repair any damaged areas of the brain. And secondly, I'd like to dissent from the thesis that you're presenting that every mental problem has a biological causation. I would put forward the theory that every social and psychological problem that human beings encounter has first a psychological causation and then a biological effect. And I'd also like
Tom, you only get two because we're running out of time.
Right. Let's take your second one first because that's a continuation of the theme we're developing. Okay. So I'm not saying that psychological events in your environment are not important. If you come home and your wife gets angry at you because you forgot to buy the milk that you're supposed to get, that's obviously a moment of irritation in your life, and that's legitimate. It's socially caused. I'm just saying you're taking in that information and you're responding to it has a biological basis. So it's really a sociobiological interaction that we're dealing with at all times. One of the points I made to Ira earlier is that it's not that the brain determines behavior in a one-way direction. Social events also affect the brain. There's a constant feedback between the two.
And in fact, may alter the brain structure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, that's number one. Number two, you raise the point, why can't learning throughout life continue to increase the neural substratum of the brain? And to a certain degree, it does. I think one of the great protections against age-related memory loss, and there's even evidence that it's a protective agent against Alzheimer's, is continuous intellectual activity.
Mm-hmm.
But you must realize the reparative capability of the brain, that is the stem cell capability, is very, very modest. So depending upon how much of an insult the brain gets, the ability to recover from it may not be adequate to overcome the deficit that's been done. So it's a very delicate balance.
Dr. Kandel, I have about 1 minute left. I want to give you my blank check question to give to a lot of researchers. If you had a blank check and could spend it on research of any amount for anything, where would you like to put the money?
Oh, gosh. Well, in line with what we're saying on the program, I think developing imaging methodology to evaluate psychological functions and to use it to evaluate the outcome of psychotherapy is something that would benefit the national health program tremendously.
So what you would like to do is be able to stick those needles...
No.
Not real needles. Not real.
You and I would do it. We wouldn't even feel it.
No, I mean imaging. I was going to say not in a real sense, but the using imaging, PET scan, CAT scans, whatever,
right,
to be able to watch the brain functioning.
Right.
As we try to heal people.
Exactly right.
And you think we're close to that?
I think we could do it. A close 5 or 10 years, yes.
Mm-hmm. And we could then tailor medication and.
No. I'm not suggesting it's a substitute.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that we are missing the power of psychotherapy because we don't have independent ways of objectifying it. And if we did, we would bring it in parallel in certain instances with drug therapy and therefore have much more effective ways of treating various mental disorders.
Well, I'll see if I can get you that check.
I'm looking forward to that. Want me to give you my address? Mail it directly to.
Right. Dr. Kandel, thank you very much.
I have a pleasure talking with you again.
Thank you very much. Eric Kandel, a Nobel laureate in physiology and medicine in 2000, a senior investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and a university professor in the Center for Neurobiology and Behavior at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons in New York. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick, Enrico Cardi, and Paul Masiello in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarians Kim Molesky and Alphonse Finn. If you missed any of the stuff we talk about, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we have links, and also you can download back editions of Science Friday onto your audible.com player. Listen to them on Real Audio. Have a great and safe holiday weekend. I'm Ira Flato in New York.